This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
It's the Mike Francesa Podcast on the BetRivers Network.
The Mike Francesa Podcast on the BetRivers Network, and it's brought to you by Casamigos Tequila. Casamigos Tequila is brought to you by those who drink it. All right, we have the Knicks playoff opponent. I will do the other playoff series in tomorrow's podcast. This one's going to be dedicated to the Knicks and some other things. We know now after the Sixers' hard-fought victory last night against the Heat that the Knicks drew a very tough opponent. I know some people wanted them not to finish the season so strong, maybe manipulate who they played. I don't believe in doing that. I believe in winning out. I believe in taking your best step into the playoffs and letting the chips fall where they may. And they fell on a tough matchup for the Knicks. But let's be honest, okay? Yes. They're going to play against Embiid. Yes, he's going to get a schedule very conducive to him staying healthy, although we'll see if he does stay healthy throughout the entire series. And yes, the Knicks are going to be underdog in the series. But you know what? If the Knicks are good enough, if they are what everybody thinks they are, they'll get through this series. They'll get a probably easier second-round matchup, especially if the freak is hurt, and it looks like he still is. I wouldn't be surprised Milwaukee gets people. We'll get to that tomorrow. But hey, this is a rough matchup. Knicks have home field, have home court. They're going to probably need it. The Sixers have been established as a 125 favorite. So you're getting plus 105 with the Knicks for the series. Sixers are minus 125. Why is that? Well, if you followed the league, you know why it is. When Embiid's in the lineup, the Sixers are the second best team in the East, not the Knicks. The Sixers went 31-8 with Embiid in the lineup. 31-8. They finished the season strongly. He is in the lineup. He's not 100%, but we know how good he is. We know what a matchup problem he's going to cause. And the schedule, 4 games in the first 9 days, days off in between every game throughout the series. So they are going to get a schedule that works for Embiid. And this is going to be a tough chore. There's no question about it. Forget what happened in the regular season. It means nothing. It means nothing because Embiid was out, but it doesn't mean anything anyway because the playoffs are different. And you have to play differently. And you have to operate differently. And your stars have to be bigger stars. Now, they have a huge star in Embiid. The Knicks have a big star in Brunson, and you expect both of them to step up. But what happens underneath them? They have a bona fide scorer in Maxey. Knicks have to hope they have a bona fide second guy, or is it going to be a different guy every day? We're going to wait and see. That's a possibility. So here's a very tough first-round matchup. Miami should have won that game last night. They didn't because Embiid made plays down the stretch, and you saw everything about Embiid down the stretch of that game if you watched it. Embiid stepped out, made a three. Embiid got an offensive rebound, clean over a player, went back up, got a conventional three. Then when they ran a double team at him, he hit Oubre for a conventional three. You saw all the parts of Embiid right there. But it was Batum that really won the game with those dagger threes, with that backhand tip back in, which was an amazing play, and then with the defense that he played. So while the much maligned Harris continues to be maligned, Batum stepped up and had a huge game against the Heat. The Heat are brilliantly coached. I thought the Butler injury was big, and he wasn't even in the game at the end. And I don't know if he's playing in the play-in game. We'll see. They wound up with Yakez having the ball too much. And I thought one of the real critical plays was when Lowry jumped him out top on the handoff and they got a backcourt violation. That was a critical play. And he threw the ball away a couple times down the stretch. He had the ball too much for my liking down the stretch, but I know Butler was hurt. And they were stubborn like they always are. They were gritty like they always are. And the game ended with the ball being deflected out of bounds and the clock running out. But, hey, they gave it all they had. They lost a one-point game. But now the Sixers and the Knicks, 2-7, starting Saturday, early evening at the Garden. Like I said, the schedule favors the Sixers. They're going to get time off. They're going to have a very conducive schedule to keeping Embiid healthy. There's some critical things for the Knicks in this matchup. Number one, the Knicks were the number one team in the league in the regular season at scoring in the final seconds of the shot clock. That's tough to do in the playoffs if you want to rely on that. So they may need a little more early offense than they got in the regular season. But a lot of times these playoff games come down to can you make a shot and can you make a shot at the end of a good defensive stand on the shot clock. So there's 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and can you step up and make that shot? Make that extra pass, make that cut, and get that shot. OG is going to be a huge key. His defensive versatility, what he can give them on the other end of the floor. When he plays, the Knicks play really well. He's got to stay healthy, number one, and he's got to give them major minutes, and he's going to be a real critical key. The other key is going to be Hart in the series. He's going to have to play a lot of minutes. He and Dante are going to have to log a lot of minutes. And Hart is going to have to get energy baskets. Normally in the playoffs, the games slow down. These aren't two teams that play at a lightning pace to begin with. But I think the Knicks have to take early offense when they can get it. When they can get an opportunity break, take it. When they can get the numbers, when they can get an advantage, they get a turnover. If they get a long rebound, go with it. Go with it. Don't and run them a little more than to their liking. That'll be positive against Embiid. And another thing is going to be how they do when Embiid's off the floor. They have to win the minutes when Embiid's off the floor. That's going to be critical in this series. He's not going to log that many minutes. Obviously, the Knicks have got to keep their bigs out of foul trouble. How they do when he's off the floor is going to be critical. Now, they don't have a frontline stopper to stop Brunson. They're going to run a lot of different people at him. We know that. We know they got veterans like Lowry. We know they can mix and match and play a bunch of different guys. They'll do that. He'll probably see three, four different guys, and we'll see which one does a better job. They did a pretty good job on him anyway this year. Again, that doesn't mean anything to me. I don't look at those regular season games. I don't even glance at them. The playoffs are a different deal. It's played at a different pace. It's played with a different intensity. And a lot of people feel that the Knicks are at a disadvantage in the playoffs because Tibbs' teams play hard in the regular season when a lot of teams don't. And they gain that edge. And now everybody plays at that pace and they don't have another year. I don't think that has to be true. I just think they have to be smart about the way they play this. And the way they've played with the versatility that they can bring, their ability to play defense, their ability to hit threes, their ability to move the ball, their ability to get what they need to get out of Brunson. They can win this series. And they're going to have to win home games. Listen, this is going to be a long series. If OG goes out, Knicks are in big trouble. If Embiid goes out and doesn't last through this series, Sixers are dead. They're not beating the Knicks without Embiid. It is not happening. But I don't think that's going to happen. They're going to watch his minutes. He's got time off between games. As we said, first four games, 9 days. Played over 9 days. They're spaced out. This series takes over 2 weeks. So you got plenty of time for him to get rest. And it's going to be critical. Now, you expect him to get his numbers. You expect Brunson to get his numbers. The question about both of them is, what are the integrity of their numbers? How many shots do they have to take to get those numbers? You know, Brunson can get his 30, and Embiid can get his numbers. But the question is, how many shots, how much harassment can you build into that game to make them uncomfortable and turn the numbers overall against the team? So how they score and how efficient the two superstars are, That's critical. Now, there's a lot of weight on Brunson's shoulders in this series. He has played at an incredible level the last couple of months. Since Randle went out, he's averaged 31 points. Late in the season, he was averaging almost 40 points a game. They need his scoring. They don't have a bona fide second scorer. Dante's going to have to make threes, but is he going to have to be a huge volume guy to do it? Hart getting energy baskets, putbacks, getting out in front and getting layups, making those charges to the basket when he has numbers, those kind of things. And I think the Knicks have to be opportunistic when they run. When the numbers are there, when it presents itself, take the opportunity break. Take it and go. Don't try to slow everything down. Run Embiid. Maxey's become a really good player. They have veteran players. They have, you know, they can get good play out of a bunch of different people, as you saw with Batum last night. Oubre. Lowry's been around the block a lot. You got Embiid and Maxey. I mean, the much maligned Harris. I mean, so they have plenty of people they can count on. And as you said, when Embiid's in the lineup, they were 31-8, and they were really efficient offensively with him in the lineup. Their efficiency cannot play at that numbers. If it does, the Knicks are going to lose. But especially the way the Knicks can play defense with OG, he is critical. He has to play, not only play, he has to play major minutes. They're going to need a lot of minutes out of Brunson, out of OG, out of Hart, out of Dante. They have bigs. They need Robinson to help. They have bigs, and they have fouls to give. They have bigs. You know what the rotation's going to be. We'll watch and see how they utilize that in the first games. And you always want to watch. The first game is always a test case, and then you look to see what major adjustments are made in game two. Game two is always critical in any playoff series because the team that does a better job making the adjustments, and they both are going to make major adjustments after game one. They have a game plan going in, but they're going to adjust it severely after game one. Then the adjustments are very minute after that. Comes down to execution. But the changes going in the game plan and then the adjustments after game one are enormous. Hey, you wanted... There's great anticipation for the series. The Knicks haven't ignited this city like this in a very long time. Everybody's pumped up. The tickets are hotter than hot. They're expensive as heck. You can't get the tickets. I mean, so they are right now a hot story, a hot ticket. This is a big deal right now. It's been a lot of years since they came in with this kind, into the playoffs with this kind of anticipation. Just having games back in that building in April and May, as we're going to have with the Knicks and the Rangers, is nice to see because it's been a long time since that's been consistent. You know, I remember, and doing the program all those years, we took for granted during those years, the Ewing years, especially the Riley years, where they were going to go deep into the postseason every year. They were going to play in the second round and the third round and sometimes deeper in the playoffs. That was a given. You knew you were going to be spending May in the Garden. And it looks like the Garden will be alive with playoff intensity in May. And that is always a very, very good sign. This is not an easy series. Don't think it is. And hey, it obviously isn't. The Sixers are favored. And, you know, they have a great player. There's no question about that. This is a tough matchup. And like I said, don't even think about what happened in the regular season. It means nothing. Absolutely nothing. Doesn't matter what they did against Brunson. Doesn't matter what happened in the game. Doesn't matter in the game he played. Doesn't matter in the games he didn't play. It makes no difference. Throw all that out as you get to this series. Playoffs are completely different. This is going to be a physical series. Who wins the boards is going to be absolutely critical. The Knicks have got to be able to hold their own on the boards in this series. They have to. They have to still be able to get baskets on the offensive rebounds. They have to. They need energy baskets from players, and they need to be able to knock down threes. Scoring in the playoffs, especially on the road, is very difficult. It's hard to do. And I told you, UV Brown always professed this from the years going back to when I used to do the NBA playoffs with CBS, going way back into the 80s. And UV would always preach, hey, you have to be able to count on your one and your two everywhere in the playoffs, home, away, on the moon. You got to get your points and your production at the level you expect out of your one and your two. Knicks don't have a bona fide two now. They have a two by committee. If you want Dante to be that guy, how many shots does he have to take to be that guy? Now, one thing about Dante is he's got great energy and he's fearless. That's what you love about all three of the Villanova guys. They're fearless. They're winners. They've been winners their whole life, and they're fearless. They bring energy. They bring cohesiveness, and they are fearless. You're going to get your best out of Brunson. You're going to get everything he's got out of Hart, and you're going to get it out of that group, especially when OG's there, because his versatility, especially on the defensive end, makes them a different team. Hart took them to one level with what he brings. OG took him to another level with what he brings. And then you throw in that they've gotten really good production from guys that you didn't know were going to produce the way they have. But that's got to be there now when the lights are brightest. And on the road, 3-7 or 3-8, that's always a question mark. And that's how you win and lose series. Their production cannot go dramatically down when they hit the road. So I think you got a classic series here in every way. You have Knicks and Sixers. You have New York and Philadelphia. You have Embiid and Brunson. I think it is everything you could want in a first-round series. And you know what? Good that it's a tough series. Prove it right off the bat. All right? There's nothing wrong with this. You're not looking for easy passes here. You're looking to go out and prove that you can be the team you think you are. I think it's going to be a very tough series. I think it's going to be a long series. Again, if something happens to Embiid, big issues for Philly. Something happens to OG and he's not as healthy as he needs to be, or Robinson, big problems for the Knicks. Not as big, though. If Embiid's out, they lose. But I don't think he will be on this schedule. I think the schedule is conducive to him staying in, and they'll watch his minutes. I think the key is the seventh game. I think it goes seven, and the seventh game's in the Garden. I think the Knicks win in seven. They're on the board. You're getting plus 105 for them in the series. I think the Knicks win, but I think it takes them seven games to do it. And seventh game, hey, when it comes to seventh games, I want them in my building. That's all there is to it. I've always believed that. I'll believe it every day that I ever watch an NBA game. I want that seventh game in my building. That's it. A couple other things. And again, we'll preview the rest of the NBA series tomorrow on tomorrow's podcast. Now, as I said, Knicks open plus 105 for the series. So numbers are conducive. If you like the Knicks, you're getting them on the plus side. Sixers minus 125, Knicks and seven. Now, Mets got a day off today as they travel to the West Coast to take on the Dodgers. They play the Dodgers and the Giants. You know, I've talked about those six games and what that would mean. When they were 0-5, you were looking at those games and saying that could put them in a hole. But you know what? The Mets have turned it around. Kudos. It all turned around, as I've mentioned to you before, on the back end of that Detroit doubleheader on that cold Thursday when in the ninth, you know, they get no hit in the eighth. Beta gets a little blue pit. Then the ninth inning, Alonso hits that home run into the wind in left center field. They win the game 2-1 on a Taylor hit. And since then, they've kept winning. Mets are 10-8. Kudos to them. 10-8. Eight of their last 10, they've won. Why? Well, a couple things jump right out at you. Number one, their pitching has been really good. Hey, it's a no-name staff except for the closer. We know that. There's no stars on the staff. But they're getting real production right now. The Mets are number one in the NL and ERA. They're number one in fewest hits allowed. They're number one in fewest home runs allowed by a good margin. They're keeping teams in the ballpark. And they're pitching well. If this keeps up, the Mets will have a much better season than people thought. Now, will it keep up? It's hard to predict because this is not a lot of named guys here. But they're doing really well right now. As you know, if you told me that the Mets were going to lead the NL in pitching, that's a heck of a deal. First in ERA, first in home runs allowed, first in hits allowed. That's why they're winning. That, and they're getting clutch hits. They've gotten, obviously, no production from Lindor. They've gotten what you expect from Alonso. That's why Alonso has to be re-signed. But they've gotten really good performances and clutch performances from Bader, from Taylor, from Beatty. They've gotten really big hits from these guys. They've had some very big hits from guys in the bottom of the lineup. They've gotten production off the bench. And they've found a way to win these games. So right now, they go into LA at 10-8 and having played really well lately. They're winning tight games. They're getting good production out of their bullpen. They obviously have an elite closer. And right now, instead of it being a dire situation, they go into LA playing good baseball. So everybody needs to give the Mets applause for what they've done here, winning 8 of 10, their manager, their team, and everything else. So kudos to them for what they've done so far. Number two, the Yankees. Yankees were sitting there on their way to 0-4 yesterday, looking at a fourth straight loss. And all of a sudden, things changed. Soto hit that home run off the lefty, gets them within two runs. Stanton hits that bomb. Now they're a run behind. Verdugo, who has started to hit, missed a double, gets himself another double. I thought the Blue Jays really screwed up in the ninth inning with their pitching, but they thought they got squeezed. I didn't think they got squeezed. I thought the 3-2 to Soto was a ball. You know how good his eye is. You know he's not going to swing. He's going to get the close pitches because of his reputation, but I thought it was a ball. I thought it was low. And then they get the big hit from Judge, who finally comes through when you thought maybe he was going to, you know, maybe he was going to struggle again. He'd been in such a slump. And then he gets the big hit down the third baseline, and the Yankees go on to a win. So they get a day off today, and they come off a big come-from-behind win. And they're getting really good performance. I mean, Soto's been everything and more. What you look at with him is his discipline at the plate is unrivaled. I mean, he knows the strike zone like few players. He is so disciplined, he will not swing. He's not going to expand the zone. And let's be honest, okay? He wouldn't expand his zone if he had Joe Schmo behind him. He's got Judge behind him. He never has to expand the zone. The walk is always going to work when you got Judge next. That's the beauty of that lineup. I mean, you have that kind of guy behind them, so they're not going to try and walk Soto ever. Now, he's going to walk anyway because that's what he does. Because you have to put the ball over the plate or he's not going to swing. And he is so balanced against lefties, it is unbelievable. His lefty-on-lefty at-bats are really a thing of beauty. They really are. I mean, if you wanted to teach somebody, you know how hard it is for left-handed hitters to learn to hit left-handed pitching. Some guys never do it, and they wind up in platoons their whole life. They just become part-time players because of the fact that they just can't hit left-handed pitching. They get it in their head, they can't hit it, and then they can't hit it. He is the instruction you want to use. I mean, his approach is so good. He never bails out. He always gets his attacking the ball the way he does and setting the count up the way he wants to get the pitch he wants. I mean, you saw him fight off some breaking balls and then get the pitch he wanted and he hits it out of the ballpark. I mean, it's remarkable what he does against left-handed pitching. It really is. I saw a lot of him when he was in Washington. We saw him a lot. We saw him in big games. We saw him a lot. But when you watch him every day, I mean, he's an even better offensive player than you thought. His defense is good. It's not great. It's fine. He's not going to embarrass himself at all. Nothing special. But his offense is really special because the approach he takes and the drive he gets and the swings he gets a good at bat every single time up. That's remarkable to see. Very few hitters. I mean, a lot of them have, excuse me, at bats. A lot of them give up a lot of at bats. He doesn't give up any at bats. And that is special when you do that. It really is. So that was a big win for the Yankees. You know, you don't want to lose four in a row to start the season despite the fast start. You know, Volpe went into a slump. Judge was in a slump. You know, they got guys not hitting. You know, when you look at it, you know, a lot of guys haven't really started hitting yet. I really wouldn't worry about it. I don't think it's a big deal. I don't think it's anything to worry about. I don't want to draw any conclusions on anything yet. As far as I told you, the one thing I would watch was I don't like some of the things I've seen from Rizzo. I have to admit that. So I would watch that and I could see when LeMahieu comes back, I could see him spending some time at first base. Rizzo's going to do enough to keep his batting average respectable. But he's not driving the baseball. And his defense does not look great. You knew Volpe is going to cool off. He had a rough series. Nothing to worry about. And leave him in the – don't jerk him around. Leave him in the – you put him in the first spot. Leave him there. It's not going to be – you know, it's not going to be he's going to hit 330 this year. He's not going to have a 400 on base percentage this year, but leave him there. He's the best guy for the job as long as he's going to take the approach he's taken this year, which is more reasonable. He's going to have games where he struck out like the other night. He's still going to have strikeouts. He had 170 last year. If he can cut that down to 120 or so this year, it'd be great. Take the ball the other way. Be a little more patient at the plate. right now, their first three hitters, Volpe, Soto, and Judge, are three of the top four players in Major League Baseball are taking pitches. They see more pitches than anybody else in the sport. They have three of the top four at the top of their lineup. That puts a lot of pressure on the pitching staff. And remember, these guys are not – think of it this way now. This is how you look at it. The other team and basically everybody, unless it's an elite starter, they don't want the pitcher to face the lineup the third time. Forget the inning. Think of that. Because that's the mental approach they're taking. They don't want him to face the lineup the third time. So the quicker you get the guy out of the game, you're in the bullpen. Now, a lot of guys don't want to rush to the bullpen now these days because there's so many hard throws in the bullpen, depending on the bullpen you face. But when you get a mediocre bullpen, then it's a feast. Soto's gotten off to a great start. Judge hasn't. Am I worried about Judge? Not in the least. Not in the least. He's got 11 RBIs. He's got three homers. I mean, if he had no homers and no RBIs, I'd be a little worried. The fact that he's hitting 180, I don't care. He'll be fine. He's got a 700 OPS. He'll be right back where he's supposed to be, 950 plus before you know it. Would I worry about Rizzo? Yes. Would I start to give Rizzo some rest? Yes. I think you have to give him some days off. Let LeMahieu play first base. Cabrera's given you enough that he deserves to play, a lot more than anybody thought he was going to deserve to play. He's done a good job. So you can play Cabrera there, and you can play LeMahieu at first. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. Stanton's the same thing you always deal with. You know that? He's going to have bad stretches. He's going to have hot stretches. He's going to hit the ball to the moon sometimes. And he can break a game. He's dangerous every time he comes to the plate. Unless you got a lightning thrower out there. If you got a hard thrower now, then you get Stanton out. You got a really elite guy who can get in his kitchen. He can get him out. Other than that, you know, he's going to hit the ball hard. When he hits the ball hard, he hits it out of the park. Torres is the guy who's off to a really bad start. Would I worry about that? Absolutely not. Listen, Torres has been the forgotten guy in here. He will get to his numbers. I understand he's off to a really bad start, and he really is. He's the guy you'd be thinking about right now, okay? He had a bad day yesterday. He's hitting 208. He's got a 554 OPS. He hasn't had any power. He hasn't done anything yet. I would not worry about him. I really wouldn't. Verdugo has started to hit. Verdugo, I told you at the start of the year, was going to give you 50 extra base hits. He's going to hit home runs at Yankee Stadium. He hits a lot of doubles. Plays with a spirit. Plays good left field. He's fine. Cabrera's giving you a plus. They've gotten nothing out of the catching. Trevino had a big hit yesterday. They obviously have gotten nothing out of Wells. Hey, your catches are defense first. You can carry a light-hitting catcher. Don't worry about your offense from your catcher. It's not the biggest importance. You need them to handle the pitching staff and handle the game, and whatever they hit, fine. You can hit for them late in the game. You got, you know, and use the other guy. Don't worry about that. So I would not make a big deal about Torres yet at all. The guy in the lineup, I would leave Stanton alone. Give him his days off. Leave him alone. The guy in the lineup I'd be worried about and I would pay attention to is Rizzo. And with LeMahieu coming back, perfect time, give him some days off and let LeMahieu play some first base. And I would not put LeMahieu back in the lead. I would not put LeMahieu in the leadoff spot. Leave Volpe there. Leave him there. I don't care if his numbers were better when he was at the bottom than at the top. Leave him alone. Let him get used to the job. It's going to be, he is the guy you wanted to bat leadoff if you had everything the way you wanted anyway. Leave him alone. Let him play there. He'll be fine. And the play he made then the game yesterday was a, you know, tremendous play. I did not think he was going to make that play. That was a tremendous play, and they kept the game. You know, Holmes is, you know, he's gotten a lot of breaks so far. He really has. He scares me. But it was a big win. Now, to a couple of other stories that have cropped up. Number one, you saw that Jontay Porter was banished for life. And he should have been. Okay, what did he do? He made bets. He knows what he can do. He knows what he can't do. By NBA standards, he's a guy that didn't make a lot of money. In his career, he's netted a couple million dollars. He's had a lot of injuries. He's Porter's brother, you know, from Denver. He's the first player since Jack Molinas. You might not know the name Jack Molinas. Jack Molinas was banished from the NBA for gambling for life in 1954. In the early 60s, it was alleged he was corrupting a couple of big-time players. One you may have heard of. If not, I would tell you as a youngster, if you want to learn something about the history of all this, read the book Foul about Connie Hawkins. Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown were local kids, and they were great players. Connie Hawkins was Julius Erving before Julius Erving. Okay, he was one of the legendary players, and he played well when he finally got to the NBA. He was banished from the NBA. He won a big lawsuit against the NBA. He didn't get as much money as he should have got. I think he got $35,000 for life, but that wasn't, you know, what he should have gotten. He played for the Phoenix Suns later on and played really well. He was an all-star, but not to the level that he was when he was in his prime. Molinas was behind that. Connie wasn't the brightest guy. He just wasn't very, he was young and he wasn't very smart. And he got himself in trouble, but he didn't do anything wrong. Now, should Porter have been banished? Yes. It's a very easy rule to follow. If you're playing in the NBA, you can't gamble. You can't get involved. You can't give information to people. You can't gamble on games. Now, here's the thing. People are wondering, what does this mean in the big picture? He deserved to go. The players understand what's at risk here, why they can't do it. You're in the NBA. You're making, for the most part, a lot of money. You're on an NBA team. You're an elite player. You're one of the best basketball players in the world just to make an NBA team. It's a great privilege to do that. Don't ruin it by, you know, betting on, you know, anything, no less basketball. He won $22,000 in his account. But what the real big one was, he gave information that he was going to sit out. So his buddy bet an $80,000 parlay. Now remember, he's a fringe player. His number was like over 5 points. Might have been 5.5, might have been 4.5, right around five. He told them, I'm not going to play. I'm going to play, but I'm going to take myself out of the game. So here's what you play. Guy bet a parlay, an $80,000 same game parlay on his under numbers. How easy would it be to red flag that bet? Who's going to wager an $80,000 parlay on a fringe player going under his numbers that night? Rebounds, points, etc. They flagged the bet. They didn't pay it off. He gave information to the guys. He actually said, he told the coach he couldn't play, that his eye was hurt, he had some eye ailment and was acting up. They caught him for this. Should he be banned for this? Yes. He in essence, he was shaving points by shaving his own points. Now, they caught this, which is the most important thing in this whole picture. More important than Jontay Porter, more important than any of this, is they caught it. It was easy for them to catch this. But it's a simple solution. What they have to do with all this proliferation of gambling, no matter what site you wager on, whether it's Bet Rivers and go to the Bet Rivers app during the playoffs, and if you're wagering, wager there. They got a great site. Or it's any of the others. You can't go there as a player and wager. You know that. But what they need to protect is the integrity. It's easy to do. Number one, they said, hey, we caught this. We red flagged it. Well, obviously, who's going to make an $80,000 same game parlay on some scrub, and whether he scores 4 points and whether he gets three rebounds or whatever it was? Nobody's going to bet. That bet's going to jump out 100 times out of 100. But there's an easier safeguard here. In college games, there should be no betting on individual player numbers. It's too hard with college basketball. College basketball is always under heavy scrutiny anyway. Nobody lets you make a big wager on college basketball because they always think you might have inside information. And because there's been a lot of stuff that's gone on through the years with college basketball. No individual numbers. Team numbers, overall numbers, fine. No individual numbers in college. It's not necessary. Number two, the most players in the league make a ton of money. Anybody who plays meaningful minutes and is in a rotation, in a top eight rotation, is making major money. They are never going to be able to make the money they make in salary gambling. Not a chance. They would never risk it. You don't have to worry about those players. Only put individual numbers on guys who play X amount of minutes per game or more. You want to make it 10 minutes. You want to make it 12 minutes, whatever it is. The guy has to play that many minutes a night. If he plays that many minutes a night, he's a guy who's making a good buck. And you don't have to worry about it. Plus, you would find it anyway if somebody tried to make that kind of wager with inside information. Now, the big game that they tried to make a coup on, they lost. Just to give you an example. So the two ways to do this and protect the sport without any question and protect everyone's integrity, because, listen, gambling only works if it's above board. If the game is shady in any way, nobody's going to gamble on it because they know that somebody's got inside information that it's not on a level. Everyone, whoever wagers on a game, wants the game to be on the level. They don't want to think somebody has information they don't have. Two ways to easily do this. Number one, if you're dealing with marginal players, combine them. Put two or three together and put the number out so that it's not one guy. Number two, just eliminate them completely. Make it only guys who play X number of minutes per game. And those guys, they're not going to risk anything. They're all major guys. They're all well-known names. Everyone knows people who are in the rotation, not just the starting five, but the sixth man, the seventh man, even the eighth man with a team. You wouldn't have to go any deeper than that. And anyone who's a fringe player below that, you don't deal with. You don't put their numbers out so that you don't have some guy doing what this guy tried to do. Make a killing by telling them, hey, guys, I'm going to fake an injury and I'm not going to do anything. I think it was points, rebounds, and under on the three-point shots. I think it was 0.5, and you know, they took the under. But they flagged this bet and they didn't pay it, so nobody got paid off. That bet is going to stick out like a sore thumb. Who is going to bet an $80,000 same game parlay? $80,000 bet. Who knows what the odds were? You would have been getting an astronomical payoff. So they made an example of him. They did the right thing. He's gone. They can send out a memorandum to the league and to each player and say, listen, here's what we expect from you. Here's what happens if you are dumb enough to do this. And that means wagering on games or providing information for any gambler. So either one of those, and you know what? You're gone. Case closed, you're gone. He's gone for life. He should be. And again, minor adjustment is all you need here. And it should be noted that they flagged the bet, which is the biggest thing of all. It did not get through. Nobody got paid off. Nobody got rich. Now, you saw this story about how it has been reported, and I don't have any information other than going by the story, and I don't know how big his role was. But they're stating now that Kraft, after Belichick's first meeting with Arthur Blank, Kraft kind of poisoned the waters with Blank about Belichick. That, in essence, is what they're saying. Said some things that were less than complimentary, made some, you know, some comments about things in his behavior and everything else. That's the report. Do I think that's possible? Yes. Were they on bad terms when at the end? My understanding was they were. Now, I don't know how big a role that played. I think there's another thing that you have to pay attention to here. Rich McKay has been in that organization since 2003. He's the CEO of the Falcons. He's been there forever. He's Arthur Blank's guy. And he and Belichick have never gotten along. And there's no question McKay did not want Belichick to be the coach of that team. So that was always going to be a major obstacle. And I still think, not knowing anything about the validity or lack of validity about what Kraft did or didn't do, do I doubt the story? I do not. But I can't confirm that I know that happened. I don't know. I think that the McKay thing played a very big role. And with Belichick now, a big thing is going to be if he does get another job, and it looks like he's going to be doing a lot of media stuff. He's going to be visible during the draft. He's negotiating with ESPN. I don't know if he's going to go there in the fall. They seem to want him in a big way. Supposedly he's working on a book. I mean, so he's got a lot of things. No one's worried about where his next meal is going to come from. If he wants to coach again, and every indication is he does so that he can break the record, how much control does he need? I actually believe, and I think this is saying something positive about Belichick, I don't think Belichick has ever demanded total control of these teams. Like, I think if Belichick comes back in the league with Dallas, if they have a bad year next year, or wherever he goes, do I think he's going to need to be completely in control of every part of the organization? I do not. Is he going to want control of his roster? Absolutely. But, you know, he deserves that. He's earned that. Does he want complete control to cut the roster? Absolutely. Does he want no interference with that? Yes. And he's earned that. No one should tell him what players to keep or not keep. Does he have to be the guy who picks every player? No. He might even want input at this stage. Does he have to handle every bit of the organization? I think he's going to want input, but I don't think he has to control it like he did in the past. He doesn't have to be, you know, the guy who does everything, who cooks the food and washes the dishes and cleans up and everything else. He doesn't have to do every job, which is what he did in New England. He was in charge of everything. And they had a great run. Wasn't pretty in the end, but you know what? Everybody's going to go through some bad years. It's whether or not you come out of that. You know, Jacksonville, if you go back, their owner at the time, Wayne Weaver, said, biggest mistake he ever made is when Jacksonville was so close to winning it all, and they went into salary cap hell to try and win it, and they didn't. And then they had to pay the piper. And they with that came some poor seasons. And Weaver fired Coughlin and admitted later it was the worst mistake he ever made. And he's right. He went on to win two Super Bowls with the Giants and two enormous victories over the Patriots. Now, all these guys, Shula had lean years, very few losing years, but lean years at the end. Didn't win a lot of playoff games. Didn't win playoff games on the road. Landry had some lean years at the end. Okay? Everybody has their moments. Belichick had some lean years at the end. He didn't have a lot of talent. Was he guilty of that? Yes. Should he have done a better job? Yes, in those years in picking players. I don't think he did a bad job coaching his team. I think he did a bad job in picking his offensive players. So I'm sure he wouldn't mind some input in that regard. So I think he'll be easier to get along with than people think. I don't think he has to have total control of the organization. I think he deserves to have control of his roster, though. I think that goes without saying. I mean, otherwise, why would you want him? If you don't want him to be in charge of that football team and be in charge of that whole roster, then why would you want him? You wouldn't take him. And he's not for everybody right now. What he should do is the perfect team for him was the team Harbaugh got. I said it from day one. He needs to go to a team with an established quarterback where he could build a team around the quarterback. And the quarterback was already there. That's what Harbaugh will do. Harbaugh will win big in with the Chargers. I don't have any doubt about it. Might take him 2 years, but I think he'll do it. I don't think there's any doubt he'll be playing in big playoff games very soon. I think Belichick was perfect for that job. Didn't happen. I don't think you want him with a rebuilding team and a young quarterback. I don't think you want him with a young quarterback. I don't think you want him with a team that's in a rebuilding phase. First of all, he's not young. He's 73 years old, I think. 72 or 73, one or the other. I know he's a couple years older than me, so I think he's 73. He needs a team with a quarterback, and hopefully the wide receivers are established because those aren't his strengths. The rest of the team is completely his strength. Game management, game planning, all that is his strength. Do I think he'll be back in the league? I do. Did I find this story surprising? Not really. But I don't think you want to make it all craft. I think you want to count McKay in as part of the reason why he isn't in Atlanta. We'll do the rest of the NBA playoffs, among other things, tomorrow. Enjoy the day.
Thanks for listening to the Mike Francesa podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.